Veteran Podcast. Thank you for your service.
Welcome back, everybody, to another edition of Bulletproof Veteran Podcast. And this is a special one coming to you on a Saturday, just livening up your weekend. And man, do we have the show to do just that. We have on the show today Nick Laveri. He is the author of Objective Secure. He's also the first Green Beret with an above-knee amputee to return to combat. And we talk all about that process and everything that went into his book and his whole lifestyle and the way he has attacked everything from even before he lost his leg in Afghanistan in 2013. All right, so I'm really excited about this one. It was a blast talking to him, so I hope you guys really enjoy and getting a lot out of this. I want everybody to go out and get this book because I really believe in the message that Nick is putting out there, and I really want everybody to get as much as they humanly can from this interview and the book. So please head over to Amazon, just type in Objective Secure, and you'll be able to see the book. It's a soft cover. Boom, you're going to get it. And I'm telling you, this is everything that we need nowadays to just combat everything that life throws at us. All right. So again, I'm amped up. I'm excited. Trust me, this guy's got the energy that's going to get your weekend going. So we're going to kind of dive right in. But before we get to Nick, as always, got a couple things. I hope everybody out there is training for the Suffolk County Veteran Run Series. First race is a 5K. Actually, no, I'm sorry. I believe that's a 4 mile in May with the I Did the Grid. I believe it's going to be the last year that they're doing that race. So please, everybody, go out to the Suffolk County Veteran Run Series website. Sign up now. Get off the couch. Get training. Do all the things you need to do to make sure that you're ready for all 9 races this year that span from May all the way into November. I'm going to be at most of them. I'm going to be running the rest of them virtually. You're going to see guys and gals that have been on the show out there. It's a great experience, and each race raises money for amazing veteran organizations, just giving back to the community. So please take a look at that. As always, you can support the show, buy a shirt, all of that on Amazon. Just Google Bulletproof Veteran on Amazon, type Bulletproof Veteran in on the Amazon search bar, and you're going to see all our different shirts, some of the new logos that are out there, some of my new wacky ideas that I think are funny, and I hope you guys enjoy them. If you do want to support the show in a monetary fashion, that's the best way to do it. As always, the best way to support the show is to spread the word to all your fellow veterans out there, and everybody in your community that can kind of gain from the people that we have on the show and the message that we're putting out there. So please do that. Continue to do that. I, as always, am getting so many emails of people that we want to have on the show. They're coming from you guys. So everybody out there who finds somebody for me to interview, thank you. I appreciate what you do. You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Rumble. You can head over to the website at bulletproofveteran.com, see information there, listen to past episodes, all that fun stuff, all right? If you have show ideas or just want to get in contact with me, bulletproofveteran@gmail.com. Again, like I was talking a little bit last week, we're working on some crazy stuff that we want to do this year, like range days and stuff like that. I have an idea of some ways that we can get together some team races and maybe do some fun, just kind of out-of-the-box things. And I'm going to be using probably the email as a way to kind of get feedback from you guys if these are things that we really want to do and how many people are really interested in participating. So keep that in mind as we kind of move forward. I think that's it for like housekeeping items. As always, we highlight a veteran owned and operated business. This week is no different. And we got a good one for you this week, all right? I had to order a refill on my coffee. I'm in between my coffee subscription for Black Rifle Coffee right now, waiting for my next bag to come in. So I wanted to branch out a little bit, try some new flavors. So we are actually highlighting Black 6 Coffee Trading Company. They've been on the show. We interviewed the founder, a first responder and a former Army medic who started the trading company. He's went to where his family is from in the Filipinos. He backpacked into the mountains and came out with his coffee. He started roasting, and that's how this was born. And what's awesome about Black Six is that the proceeds from a lot of their sales go to the Black Six Project, which is all about providing humanitarian aid all around the world and getting veterans involved in going to different places and helping. All right, these people, you know, in places that have had tsunamis, earthquakes, volcanoes, hurricanes, all of that stuff. They have programs to provide water in different places that need, filtered drinking water and that type of stuff. So they are just an amazing organization. And let me tell you, the coffee is phenomenal. All right. Phenomenal. I am going with the limited edition Giovanni Castro, which was a Colombian bean. And I can't wait to get this into my coffee mug and just enjoy it. I'm really looking forward to it. Like I said, I just ordered it. And I said, you know what? This is the perfect high octane caffeinated life that we need in the episode with Nick talking about all the crazy things that he's involved in. So I think the two blend together perfectly. And please go over to black6coffee.org. Check out all the different coffees, Philippines, Costa Rica, Guatemala, Colombia. They have a bunch of different things that you can purchased there. They have whole bean ground. They have it ground for French press or drip. They have some, you know, hats and shirts and that type of stuff. And you can read all about the Black Six Project while you're over there. So again, head over to black6coffee.org. Support another amazing veteran owned and operated business. All right. All right. I think that's it. I think that's enough. I think we're just going to enjoy everything that Nick brings to the table. He's got a lot of energy, and it's just the right day, you know, to do that on a Saturday, get you kind of charged up to tackle that entire weekend. All right. So without further ado, let's get to this week's interview. All right, everybody. Welcome back to Bulletproof Veteran Podcast. I am honored to have on the show today, Nick Lavery. All right. You probably know him. If you're in the veteran circles and you're following stuff on Instagram and all of that, you've probably run across his page. He's very popular on Instagram. He's got a big following, and there's a reason for it, because he's helping people realize their goals. All right. He's got a new book out. It's called Objective Secure, and that's all about achieving your goals. All right. And it doesn't matter how far-fetched that goal is. It could be the craziest thing that you've ever thought of in your head. What he's trying to do is give you the tools to get there and achieve that goal. So, Nick, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, Jason. Great to connect, brother. Looking forward to it.
Excellent, man. Now, there's reasons why you are an expert in this, because you had a lot of roadblocks put in front of you, but yet you still got past them and you were able to achieve your goals of staying in the military, becoming a warrant officer. I mean, hell, man, you're the first person, I think, ever to go to combat dive school as an above-knee amputee. There's also a few other accolades for people redeploying with above-knee amputee. So your story is amazing. So why don't we start there, man? Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you came from, your military, all that stuff.
Sure, man. Yeah. So born and raised predominantly in Boston, Mass, which most people would have figured out here pretty quick.
Pretty quick.
I did move around a lot. I consider myself kind of a nomad of the Massachusetts kind of East Coast, because I moved every like 12 to 18 months as a kid, which we'll probably circle back to and kind of how that molded me along the way and enabled me to do some stuff much later in life. Began looking at the military in high school. I went to high school in Dorchester, and I didn't have much of a direction as a young kid. I got in trouble a lot. Was not an academic. Hated school. Did really poorly in school. Started looking at the Marine Corps, and met with a Marine Corps recruiter actually my sophomore year. And he's like, "Yeah, man, go, you know, graduate college or graduate high school and come back, and we'll get you in." So I had kind of a direction
right
in high school. What stopped that from happening, or what made me really divert, was I started getting recruited to play football in college. So that was the only reason why I went to college. I went and played up at UMass Lowell, D2 ball.
Mm-hmm.
And again, still not an academic at all. Just kind of doing the bare bones minimum to stay eligible to play. And my sophomore year of college was 9/11, right? So obviously an impactful day for a lot of us. And, you know, I can remember the feeling of seeing that happen in real time. And it was like the planes were flying into me. Right? Mm-hmm. Like I was angry and I wanted revenge. And I could see the direction we were going in. Like I was confident we were going to war. And I really struggled with staying in school because I wanted to be a part of that. Ended up listening to some mentors and some family. And I ultimately stayed in. I grinded out my degree, which was painful and challenging. And then started looking at options to enlist after that. I ended up landing in the Army mostly because at the time they were the only branch that provided an option to get guys off the street directly into special operations.
Okay.
I knew I wanted to go into special ops, and the 18 X-ray contract, otherwise known as the special forces recruit contract, which is still an option today. That was the only option of its kind at that time. So it gave me the quickest route into special ops. But then I also did some research into what Green Berets do, what Special Forces detachments do, because I really didn't know. And I was drawn to the mission sets that we are responsible to execute. So it's kind of a win-win. Came in as an enlisted guy, even though I did have my degree.
Mm-hmm.
Came in as an enlisted guy. I wanted to be a worker. I wanted to be one of the guys getting my hands dirty and doing stuff. And then, on my second combat rotation into Afghanistan was when things kind of took a dramatic shift. I'm sure we'll get into it.
Mm-hmm.
The result of that deployment was the ultimate loss of my right leg above the knee. And I continue doing that same stuff to this day. I'm still on a detachment to this day as a chief of warrant officer. And to kind of round out kind of my intro, and certainly putting saving the best for last, is I'm a family man.
Mm-hmm.
I'm married. My wife is active duty military. She's actually currently deployed right now. And we are the proud parents of two young boys. One is 4 years old, who you'll probably hear barge here through the office door any minute.
Mm-hmm.
And then our youngest is 11 months. So
wow,
they are the highlight of my life without question. They are deeply rooted in the why behind just about everything I do. And that's kind of a basic Wave Top rundown.
Yeah, I'm the same way as far as family. I have a 3.5-year-old daughter who is my world. I mean, is my world beyond anything. I mean, don't get me wrong. Love my wife. She's amazing. You know, I'm sure you can understand. I mean, your wife's got 11 months old, then going for a deployment. That's got to be pretty tough on her. I give her a lot of credit, a lot of kudos, strong woman to be able to do that and know that everything's going to be okay home with you guys. But I'll tell you what, my little girl, that's my whole world. That is my, like you said, that's my why. You know, whenever it's a crappy day at work, well, I do it because of her.
Yeah, man. It's wild, isn't it?
It's crazy.
All the things that were the most important things in life as when you were not a parent, right? Like all your priorities and just like, I'll never forget Holden, my oldest, for the first time. It was like in that moment, man, my priorities just got completely jumbled and swapped around. And in that instant, things that were the most important thing in the world to me, all of a sudden were taking a back seat. And it's a gift, man. It truly is a gift. So congratulations on the same journey that I'm on.
Yeah, yeah. No, definitely, definitely. It's and trust me, it is a journey, man. Man, it is. But it's fun. It's a lot of fun. I always I used to have her doing planks when she was like 2 years old. I would have her do planks, and I have videos of her saying, "Hey, listen, it's only, you only have 16 years to pararescue indoc course. You got to get to work. We don't have time to be playing around."
Love it.
But I want to pedal back a little bit and talk a little bit about what happened March of 2013. Obviously, a big part of your life is that day. March 11th, 2013. Was an insider attack. So this wasn't the quote-unquote normal thing that we were seeing in Iraq at the time with the roadside bombs. So many service members have that story, amputated limbs due to roadside bombs, IEDs, all these different things that were going on. Your situation was a little bit different because this was an insider attack. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, and you mentioned the date, which, you know, I look at the calendar and it's actually coming up here in a few weeks.
Yes, sir.
Which isn't something you'd think that date would like stick out to me more than it does. And usually I'm reminded once I start seeing the memorials of some of my teammates and friends that were killed on that day. That's usually what reminds me. The fact that I lost my leg that day is like a secondary memory. Just kind of going wave tops. We're on the back end of a 6-month deployment. You know, we had only 2-3 weeks left in country. We're about to do a massive or a larger scale joint operation, which means we had a lot of different partner force elements that we were working with. We were teamed up with an Afghan National Army SF team that lived with us during that deployment that we would do a lot of our ops with, just with those guys.
Mm-hmm.
On the larger missions, larger objectives, we would bring in guys from the conventional army, the national police, the local police, just depending on the size of the target and some of the other variables. This particular day was one of the bigger ones. So we had a lot of different guys that were coming up to go on this mission with us. And we established an SOP, a standard operating procedure, months prior. When we would do these larger scale missions, we would keep the troops outside of our compound, and then the leadership would come in to our motor pool area, and we would brief them on what we were doing, and then they would go relay that to their sections, and then we would roll. Just because it's a real vulnerable position to be in, inside your wire, with a lot of people moving around you with weapons. So mm-hmm. we wanted to minimize that. On this particular day, leadership comes in, but also a Ford Ranger pickup truck drives in as well. And at the time, I was a weapons sergeant. You know, we were responsible for weapons and tactics, and one of our primary responsibilities is base security. So I see this as that violation of our SOP immediately. And I find myself at a crossroads, right? Do mm-hmm. I either address this situation right here and now and kind of err on the side of security, or do I wait and address this with my leadership, who will then talk to their leadership and kind of go the more diplomatic approach and err on the side of rapport and relationship? So like, you know, it's real easy even as a service member to say like, how do you not just jump on top of that immediately? Which was of course my first response. It's not quite as black and white when you're an SF guy on an SF team, because we don't do anything by ourselves. Like what determines mission success for an SF ODA is the relationship you have with your partner force,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's not quite as cut and dry, and you are sacrificing security oftentimes for the sake of that relationship. So it's a very difficult balance.
Yeah. And they, so like a lot of people don't understand, I think, that concept mm-hmm. about SF. You know, you see movies and they talk about special forces and it's Rambo running in, killing a bunch of people, you know,
right. Right.
What people don't realize. And if you read a lot and you talk to SF guys, majority of your guys' job is that relationship with your partner forces. I mean, having and building that relationship, that's everything. You know, when I've spoken to other guys, that's what it is.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, you of course need to have the baseline shoot, move, communicate. You need mm-hmm. you need to be a unilateral fighting force when necessary. But, you know, you don't send an SF ODA places to conduct unilateral operations, meaning just them by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
We make our money through unconventional warfare, which just in the definition means you're working by and through indigenous personnel. That's why you send Green Berets places, which is an important thing to touch on. I'm glad you brought that up, Jay, because, you know, again, it's tough to look at what the decision process that I went through and go, man, you're out of your mind. Like, how could you not jump on top of that? And, you know, it's just, again, it's not quite that simple. And again, this is really why you put SF guys in those places, to make those rapid decisions and to mitigate those threats as best as possible, knowing you have to foster and maintain delicate relationships at the same time. It's really challenging.
Of course.
To kind of blitz through it, man, you know, we get done with our mission brief. A dude, Afghan national officer, jumped on the back of that truck, opened fire using that Russian PKM, it's a belt-fed machine gun, into the group from about 20 feet away. The result of that was 12 U.S. casualties, including 3 killed. another half dozen up to a dozen Afghans that were killed or wounded. The damage to me was mostly done to my legs. I took around 4 or 5 rounds to my right leg and one to my lower left leg. The most significant of that being to my right leg, shattered femurs, severed femoral artery, a real bad day. My right leg was just complete and total trash.
Mm-hmm.
I treated myself initially with a couple tourniquets. Teammates got to me, additional tourniquet, but you know, I knew the bleeding was likely not going to stop based on the size of my leg. And it's a femoral artery that's been severed. So I ultimately end up grabbing some gauze and I ram it into my own thigh and I'm reaching, feeling around for the femoral. I find it. I think I find it. I press down on it. I secure a tourniquet on top of it. And that's ultimately what did stop the bleeding, because I was on the ground almost 90 minutes before the first medevac bird could land because it was an ongoing firefight. Like, this guy clacked off on the inside of our perimeter, but it was a complex attack. So we also started receiving rockets and machine gun fire
right
from outside of our compound. So yeah, I mean, I attribute me being alive today mostly due to the medical training I had received by my team medics. And then just, you know, a lot of just luck, because I really couldn't feel what I was touching. I just happened to take a shot and I, you know, I nailed it dead on.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's ultimately what, you know, what saved my life. And just to fast forward a little bit, I was in Afghanistan another 5-6 days after that, so that they could stabilize me enough to survive a fixed wing flight to Germany,
Which
eventually I did. I was in Germany for just a day. And at this point, they started incrementally amputating my leg. In Germany a day, and then I arrived to Walter Reed. And then just the continuous small millimeter at a time amputation process began, where they were really fighting infection at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Something that could have killed me easily. I ended up going through about 30, 35 surgeries on my right leg alone at Walter Reed. And then just begin kind of the basics, learning how to live life as an amputee, learning how to use a prosthetic. I was there about a year, and then I returned back to my unit at Fort Bragg.
That's pretty crazy that in a year you were back to your unit in Fort Bragg. Because to me, a year is nothing. I blink and a year goes by. And when you're going through, like you said, multiple surgeries, all of that, the rehab, plus the mental side of it, losing your buddies, obviously dealing with the fact that, you know, this was an attack inside the wire, you know, you were part of decisions that were made that, I mean, at that point, you had to be kind of second guessing yourself. It's human nature to do that. Even if you did everything that you know is right, you still second guess yourself. I second guess myself when I don't buy the right milk, for Christ's sake. You know what I mean? Let alone a life and death situation. So when you tell me you're back at your unit in a year, I'm sorry, that blows my fucking mind, man. It really does.
Yeah. It was definitely fast. You know, the docs at Walter Reed, the med staff, who are just an amazing mm-hmm. group of human beings, unbelievable. They're real cautious about kind of setting expectations, because most of us are like, I got to get out of here. They're real cautious about it. But generally speaking, it was kind of estimated I'd be there around 2 years, give or take. You know, I attribute the speed in which I got back to my unit so fast really twofold. One is my focus on getting back to my profession, getting back to my job. I was already in the realm of completely and totally obsessed with that ultimate end state while at Walter Reed. So you mentioned mentality, like my mindset, and I went through a lot of difficult times,
of course, struggles
and failures, but generally speaking, I was so focused and honed in on this objective that it blocked out a lot of the other noise. And I think that that helped just speed things up. So there was that. And then again, to come back to the staff that was there that really enabled me and taught me how to do just about everything, amazing people. So that the combination of having that very clear vision and clarity behind what I'm doing, and then having the resources next to me, the tools to facilitate that vision, I think that's really what enabled the speed in which I got back.
And now, you weren't married at the time.
I had met my wife. We knew each other.
Okay.
But we weren't married.
You weren't married. Okay. Now, family, was there communication with family through a lot of this? Did they know you were injured at this point? Like, did they find out kind of, you know, down the road? Like, were you in Germany? Were you already at Walter Reed by the time they found out that you were injured?
Yeah. So our next of kin alert processes are pretty fast.
Yeah.
So my family, my parents, my sister, they were made aware of me being wounded relatively quickly.
Okay.
Say within maybe 24, 48 hours.
Okay.
What's interesting about that is on that same deployment, I had been wounded in action twice before that, two separate instances. So I took some shrapnel with the back of my shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few months later, I took an AK-47 round to the side of the face, both of which sound a lot worse than they really were. You hear someone saying they got shot in the face. It's like, well, how am I even talking to you right now? Right. So, but you know, relatively significant injuries. I had to get medevaced, I had to get put back together, but I was right back in the fight. So my parents had received that call twice before. And then the result of that very quickly was, you know, he's fine. He's going to get back to the guys here soon. We were required to make you aware. So they were somewhat conditioned to receiving that phone call. And in a lot of ways, it almost set them up for failure a little bit, because they received that third phone call and they're like, hey, Nick's been wounded again. And they're like, okay, like that's my son, who's just like this maniac who just keeps getting shot and blown up. But I'm expecting you to tell me he's fine and he's going to go back to work.
Right.
And obviously the result of that was different. So it changed things rapidly. And they were like, oh, okay. And they're like, yeah, he's like in critical condition. We need to get you on a flight to Walter Reed, like now, because we don't know how long he's got to live. So then, you know, wheels start getting spun up, logistics, assets, and support start coming in, and they load them on planes. And they were there as they rolled me off the ambulance when I first arrived to Walter Reed.
Yeah. And the reason that kind of popped into my head is you talk about your hyper-focus and your drive to get back to your unit. Family members don't have that same focus. And I think that gets glossed over a lot when we talk to people that have been injured or have sicknesses, cancers, heart disease, whatever it is. The person going through it copes with it the way they do. Your way of coping was to be focused. I'm getting back to my unit. I don't care what I have to do. I'm going to do that. Those parents probably have a different mindset of, no, you are not fucking going back and doing this shit again. Keep your ass in this bed.
Yeah.
You know, was that kind of the situation, or was your family like, no, that's what he needs to do. Let's whatever we got to do to support him to get him back to where he's healthy. That's it.
Yeah. So it's an awesome point, man. And a lot of what I'll touch on here right now wasn't made aware to me for years later. We were able to have those kind of retrospective conversations after I'd already been back and keep doing what I'm doing. The answer is they knew they needed to be supportive of me no matter what that was to keep me in a positive mentality.
Okay.
Right. That said, nobody, including them, really thought that what I was trying to do was possible. You know, it hadn't happened before. So it's reasonable to assume, you know, let's be in his corner. Let's support this. That's not going to happen. So it's okay. You know, we'll address that crossing roads when we get there. And he realizes that this isn't a practical goal that he has.
Mm-hmm.
So let's be supportive and keep him in the right mindset, which they did. You know, then they also, they know me pretty well. So in the back of their minds, they're going, well, what if he actually like pulls this off? Like, I know it hasn't happened before, but like, he's kind of determined to do this. And then in comes the fear of, well, what if that does happen? So they're struggling with kind of all three of those realms. We want to be supportive. We don't think this is practical, but just what if? And I give them a lot of credit because I couldn't see that within them
right
in that time. They were just, my father lived with me at the hospital for the first, you know, 6-7 months that I was there. And he was like my right-hand man, like both literally and figuratively.
Right.
So doing a lot of stuff physically for me that I can do. And then he's at the training sessions. He's in my physical therapy sessions. He's right there next to me when I'm in the gym. He's my biggest fan then and now. It took him a while to be able to come to me and say, hey, bro, like, I love you. I know that you can do some amazing stuff, but I really didn't think that this was possible. So they went through a roller coaster ride.
And I'm again, sure. Man,
you know, family members, your kid, your son, your nephew, your daughter, whoever's going overseas into combat, like that's scary no matter what. And I can appreciate that more now that I'm a father.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't give them enough credit for that, their ability to put that aside and be that means of support for me when I needed it the most, and battling the fear that was there and also hiding successfully their doubts of whether or not it was actually possible.
Right. Right. I mean, it's true. And even getting back to your unit, it wasn't over then. It wasn't like, okay, now he's, you know, back to his unit. They're going to give him some type of a staff job, a desk job, something like that. And we don't have to worry about this anymore. Because you went right into, you got back to your unit in what, 2014, give or take. And you spent the next year demonstrating that you could deploy, not only deploy, but deploy as a Green Beret into combat. And it was in 2015 that you actually got cleared to do that. What was that process like? Because that must have been freaking interesting. You know, the military has a weird way of dealing with people. And I'm sure that was unique because, again, you're the first one that ever really did it.
Yeah, man. First off, it was an administrative slugfest that I had to go through.
Of course.
The Army, I'm a part of the Army Special Forces, but I'm also part of the Army. Like, mm-hmm. we fall under the Army, and the Army's got policy and processes to deal with severely wounded people.
Mm-hmm.
I had to fight through that. And it was at times just refusing no and clawing my way around bureaucratic systems and echelons to get to that next level of authority to put their stamp and their signature on something. So I had to go really out of my way just for the Army to keep me on active duty status. Once that happened, then my next fight was to return back to the team. So it was really kind of twofold. When I got back to Fort Bragg, at the time I was in 3rd Special Forces Group. I'm currently in 5th out of Fort Campbell. But I get back to my unit. I sit down with my command, all echelons of command, in the same sit down. And they're like, great to have you back. You know, what are your goals? And I told them in that first initial conversation, I'm going back to my team. And they said, okay. Well, is that something that you can do now? And I'm like, no, I'm not even close to that yet. You know, I need a job here. I need to provide value. I need to work. But that's ultimately where things are going. So it was put on their radar immediately. I requested to work as a combatives instructor in the Special Operations Combatives Program Committee, which is hand-to-hand combat, which was a great fit for me. Grew up boxing, doing jiu-jitsu, MMA. It was awesome. It was a big part of my life prior to getting wounded. They gave me that that privilege to work on that committee. So I'm working as an instructor day to day, which was my day job. But really, I looked at my job as increasing my recovery as fast and as aggressively as possible. So my day to day job was almost like a side hustle, because what I was doing first thing in the morning, throughout the day, at night, was mostly physical training. And I was training at a level in which I didn't know existed as a two-legged dude. I talked about being obsessed. I mean, I was borderline out of my mind.
Really?
Obsessed.
Yeah.
Into the realm of reckless several times, and learned those hard lessons on, you know, how hard can you really push it before mm-hmm. the wheels fall off. So, I'm playing that game. And after working as an instructor for about 8 months, I decided I was ready to take a shot. And I didn't know what that process looked like. You know, fortunately, in kind of a morbid way, 3rd Group at the time owned Afghanistan. That's all we did. So there were a lot of wounded guys in my unit, amputees that were still in the unit, still serving. None of them were back on an A team deploying back to combat, but guys had shown that they could stay around and be of value. So those dudes did kind of soften the trail for me to follow. It did get to a point where that trail ended, because none of them had gotten past that point. So I didn't know what to expect. And my unit just kind of started throwing different assessments and tests at me. It started very basic, you know, like 12-mile road march, kind of a basic Army fitness evaluation. Go do that. And then I would do it. And they say, okay, cool. Now go do Army physical fitness test. Go do that. Okay. And it's just week after week, sometimes one or two a week, I would do a different assessment or test. Most of it was around the physical realm, but then it started to expand into my ability to actually perform my job as a weapons sergeant, sort of like a proficiency evaluation, cognitive assessments, another psychological screening, which again, I think was because some of the guys around me actually thought I was clinically insane the way that I was going about my day, just out of my mind. They're like, we need to get this guy evaluated for his mental sanity because we actually have some concerns. You know, the result with that was the psych's like, yeah, he's no crazier than he was before. So he's good as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
So about a 12-week process of different assessments and tests. And at the culmination of that was the kind of the Super Bowl physical evaluation that I went through. And at the result of that, you know, I kind of demonstrated enough for our commander to assume that level of risk because this is unprecedented. And he knew he was going to have to answer the mail if things went sideways. He decided to extend. He felt I had demonstrated what he needed to see. And then I was back on the team, you know, the next week. And then they were already really far in their train up because we were back in Afghanistan like 2 months after that. So flash to bang was right around 2 years from when I was wounded to when I was boots back on the ground in Afghanistan.
And what was the reaction from that team when you joined? I mean, I would imagine there was a lot of support because those are usually close-knit groups. But was there any kind of look of, man, we're not okay with this. We don't think this is a good idea. Because I can see it from both sides. You know, these are, you guys are all, you know, high performers. You're used to being the best of the best. And you're used to going into pretty shitty places where you know bad things can happen. It would be, you'd be a human being to say, man, I don't know if we're ready to assume this risk to do this. Even though he showed he could do it, I'm not okay with it. Was there anything like that?
An awesome question. Super important. I can't answer this without saying that the earlier phases, me at Walter Reed, and even once I got back to my unit, I'm working as an instructor, I'm training, I'm getting bigger, stronger, faster. I actually stopped going through these different assessments. Up until that point, Jay, it was all about me. Mm-hmm. It was very selfish. And it was me proving myself right, me proving everybody wrong, stubbornness, competitiveness, a little bit of ego and pride mixed in there. It was about me getting back to doing what I wanted to do. And I'm maybe a week or two into these assessments, and I'm doing well, and I've got momentum, and I feel confident. And I wake up in the middle of the night around 3 a.m., in a cold sweat, panicked. And it hit me that I was trying to go back to a team that had 10 or 11 other guys on it. And as part of being on that team, you are literally putting your life in someone else's hands and they're doing the same with you. And these are guys with wives and kids. And it scared the hell out of me. Like, am I going to go back and be a liability? And I hadn't thought about it until that moment. And I after not sleeping the rest of the night, first thing that morning, I bomb in. And I get with my teammates and I'm like, guys, we need to have like a conversation here because at this point I've had these blinders on. I can't see or hear anything else other than where I'm going. And I did not consider this until right now. And I just don't know, is this in the best interest of the team? And these guys have been alongside me this entire time,
Right. Physically
and otherwise, training with me, pushing me, helping me adapt different exercises and different tactical tasks and stuff like that. These guys were right there. But we hadn't had that candid, no bullshit conversation. And I'm saying, guys, are you just here because you want what's best for me, because you love me and you want me happy? Or do you really think this is in the best interest of you guys and the team and your families? And they said, Nick, here's the deal. We've had this conversation several times already. The answer is we don't know. We don't know what this will look like if you're able to actually get back here with us. But what we do know is we want you to keep pushing and at least give us a chance to take a look at it in real time and then make that decision then. And they said, you know, we're going to be the first ones to tell you if it happens that, hey, man, this just isn't going to work.
Right.
And I'm fortunate to, you know, work in an industry where you have to have pretty thick skin and be willing to give and receive, you know, negative, harsh criticism. That's part of what makes us better, is just accepting the fact that, yeah, man, like, we did a horrible job here, or, hey, you just botched that. Here's what I saw. Here's what we need to work on. So ultimately, Jay, I put my trust into those guys
right,
to be able to have that objective perspective and give it to me, because even though I was now thinking along those lines, and it did increase my output because it no longer was about me. When I was walking into a training facility for a workout, I wasn't thinking about myself getting back to Afghanistan and bringing the fight back to the enemy and getting that vengeance I wanted. I was now thinking about, you know, my teammate's son and training as hot as I could for that kid. And that just bumped things up a whole nother level. So my productivity, my work ethic, my output all shot up after that kind of transition. But again, I ultimately put my faith into those guys that they would be the ones to have that objective look. And if things were looking like it wasn't going to work out, they would be the first to tell me, and I would respect that. And then I would move on to the next, you know, the next evolution.
Yeah. And it's good. And listen, it's good that you had that moment, that cold sweat, wake up in the middle of the night type of moment, because like you said, it made it all really work when you think about it in the end, because 2015 rolled around, you joined your team and you deployed back to Afghanistan, which I have to believe was kind of fucked up, because you're now going back to the place where this all happened. And like you said, kind of a complete circle at that point. You're back with your team. You're in Afghanistan. But it's not the same, because you're kind of blazing a trail for people at that point. You have more weight on your shoulder to perform now, because it's like you said, now it's about the team. It's about everything else that's going on. It's about proving that this is possible, not just a personal thing. And it's not just, I only have to think about myself. So it's pretty amazing that that all happened. Like you said, within 2 years, it's kind of crazy.
Yeah. And I give my teammates and team leadership and even my unit leadership a lot of credit, because the last thing an SF team wants is a lot of visibility on them. People making phone calls. How's it going? What's going on? SF teams want to be dropped off on a mountain somewhere or in the middle of a desert and just left alone for 6 months to execute a mission. The fact that I was back on that team, that had visibility all the way up to Washington.
Right.
And people were making phone calls all the way down the chain of command. I didn't really know this at the time. They were safeguarding me from it, but my team leadership were dealing with those emails and phone calls consistently. How's Nick? How's the team? How's it going? You know, so I already knew that the pressure was on, where if one, even just a minute thing happened, they would have yanked me off that team in 2 seconds, because there was just so many people looking at it. So I give my team leadership a lot of credit for putting up with that, as well as my teammates. And then you're right. You know, I kind of come full circle. I'm back exactly where I want to be. It was like I'm on the top of this mountain, hands in the air, popping champagne bottle, you know, spraying on each other, the whole thing. And then immediately after that, I realized how many gaps I still had in my tactical game.
Mm.
That I didn't even think about while I was training back at Fort Bragg. Most of what I was doing training wise was in the gym or a training facility to get bigger, faster, stronger. The tactical tasks was one that I paid some attention to, but not nearly enough. And I realized very quickly, I may be at the top of a mountain, but I'm now at the bottom of another one that I have to climb very quickly. So even though the pressure was on, I really didn't feel it. And I get asked about, like, were you able to trust the partner force that you were working with because of what happened to you? And the answer is, you know, we still went about our methodology the same way we normally do in terms of risk mitigation. But I was so focused on closing those gaps that I had that I really didn't get the chance to spend any mental bandwidth or emotional energy on that stuff. Even simple things, Jay, like getting in and out of a tactical vehicle. Right. Like the way you do that with two legs versus the way I do it now are wildly different. Like, tactical vehicles are not built for comfort or efficiency. They're built for a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So the first time I went to get in one, I'm literally like, I don't even know how to do this. Even with all the time in the world, you know, I've got my teammates put me on a stopwatch. They're videotaping me. They're competing against me for time. I'm like, how can I shave off a second or two if I put my hand here, put my right foot here? I'm just dissecting a movement that otherwise would be something you would do without even thinking about it. I was just going task by task in incessant repetition. So my mental focus and my physical energy were consumed with training ops and my own personal training and development that I really didn't get a chance to absorb or really feel the impact of the pressure that, you know, me and my team were really under.
Now, was this the time, like you talk about, like this process, you know, that you're going through to do all these different things? Would you say that this was kind of the time when you started to, even if you didn't write it down, but start to formulate your whole, you know, the objective secure mentality and this ethos that you were kind of coming up with, which obviously in, you know, 2022 created a book, you know, and, you know, you were writing it well before that, but it was published in January this year. Was that all starting on that, you know, from Walter Reed to Fort Bragg to that first deployment to learning to getting in and out of tactical vehicles to just doing your basic tasks that you have to do? Is that where this came from?
The short answer is yes.
Okay.
It is. However, it was not laid out in this very clear, articulate, easy to follow system that is now what is now objective secure. Right. Mm-hmm. So it was iterative and it was fluid in nature. And I learned the process as I went, mostly through, you know, failure and things not going as optimized as they could, or me flat out falling on my face. And then retrospectively looking back at like, what am I doing to get to this point? Like, why am I not progressing in this area or that area? It really wasn't until I had some advanced training on like operational art and design, like big picture macro kind of campaign strategy type schooling I went to, that I started to learn these more advanced military training systems and methodologies to conduct large scale operations that obviously has a lot of complex aspects within it. So I started getting some more advanced military training and took that and started applying it to myself and kind of cleaning things up as I was still executing and still messing things up. But that the shot group was kind of coming in and getting more and more narrow and more streamlined and more efficient and more optimized. But it wasn't really, man, until I decided to write the book in the early phases of what that initially was, which was just a really quick cut and dry manual, that I really spent some time looking back through my training logs, looking back through my journals, and just reflecting on answering the question, how did I do what I did?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't really until I laid it all out, which was the early portion of what became the manuscript for that piece, that it became kind of what it is now, which is just very cut and dry and systematic.
Right, right. You know, and it's kind of interesting that you have that analog between battlefield education, so strategic education, and yourself, and how you can use that like you said, that macro look, and then, you know, it zeroes down into a mission and, you know, a goal and then a personal goal. It's really kind of interesting how you're not the first person I've heard to do something like that. But what I think is really very cool about how you've done it is you're taking probably the worst case scenario for somebody like yourself, which is a high charging person, take away their leg. Now try to do it. That's kind of almost a worst case scenario. And I'm not saying that being dead is worse or not, but in a lot of ways, some people would have said, listen, I'd rather be fucking dead. I'd rather be dead. And then this would just all be over. I think it's more difficult sometimes for people like yourself to turn around and be like, now I have to try to do all the things that I want to do without this appendage that enabled me to do those things.
Yeah, it brings up an awesome point, and two things come to mind to touch on. One is exactly that: is I grew up an athlete. I got to SF. My team asked of me, and what I enjoyed doing and what I was good at was the physical stuff.
Of course,
right? 6'6", 275, MMA fighter. All I did was fight, shoot, and spend time in the weight room, and it was a win-win. I gave the team what they needed. I enjoyed doing it. I was good at it. Perfect. You lose your leg, and when you are that connected to the physical production that you create as part of who you are, that in itself is a challenge, just to get past that and recognize that no matter how much time I spend in the gym or the weight room or on the track, I am never going to be as physically dominant as I was with two legs. Accepting that reality oftentimes is a bridge too far for a lot of guys.
Yeah.
And they spiral downward. I'm fortunate that I was able to get past that relatively quickly. And then to take it a step farther, I talked about going to, you know, operational art and design companies like macro specialized campaign planning schools.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why I went to that exact course and other ones like it was because once I accepted the fact that I was not going to be as physically dominant as I was, I began looking at, okay, that's the reality. I know I'm going back to a team. How can I bridge the gap, make up the difference between what I'm going to lose physically and still be that asset that the team needs of me? How do I do that? So I began looking at other aspects outside of the high speed, kick down doors, shoot dudes in the face stuff that we all love. I started looking at the other areas and skill sets within what creates really high performing Green Berets and high performing ODAs, SF teams, kind of sort of the softer side of our business. I started looking at those areas, right? Cultural awareness, foreign language capability,
mm-hmm.
macro strategic planning, intelligence operations fusion, targeting, like some of these more like nerdier stuff that we do that I wanted nothing to do with prior to that point. No one ever asked me to do any of that stuff because they didn't need me to. I started looking at those areas. This is still when I was at Walter Reed, and I kind of mapped out a game plan. Okay, I can go to this school. I can learn. I can get better at this. I can get better at that. I started reading these weird, you know, cultural type works, stuff I would never do. And the key about that is I absolutely despised it. Like, it was painful to go through that process because I didn't enjoy it at all. It was fueled solely on believing in the strategy and the discipline to execute when you don't want to, and operating on faith that this will come full circle and you will be able to make up that difference. And, you know, that first Afghanistan deployment 2015 as a one-legged dude, I was actually able to employ a lot of those different skill sets that I otherwise wouldn't have had. And it just kind of gave me some validation to what I believed to be true then. And it actually proved to be the case, you know, within a three-dimensional, you know, reality.
Yeah. And it's funny that you say that you hated that stuff, but I have to ask, like, did conquering some of that stuff that you hated give you the same, we'll call it serotonin or dopamine hit that you get from the physical activity that you used to do, say, so that gap as well? Because I have to say, you probably got your rocks off being that physically fit freaking guy who was an animal in the gym, football, like you said, all of that. Did that help bridge the gap at all, trying to tackle new skills that you didn't want to do really and it was difficult because you really didn't like it? When you completed it, did you look back and go, fuck yeah, I could do that too?
Yeah, I don't think it was the same kind of physiological response right. You get from a hardcore workout, but certainly reaching the top of a ridgeline and looking down and saying, you know what, I hated that and it was challenging and painful, but I made it, and that's something to be proud of.
Right.
I think what the greatest takeaway for me was by going through that in repetition with different skills and different schools and different aspects of making me more well-rounded was the importance of discipline, mm-hmm. the importance of discipline and kind of the motivation being somewhat overrated. And you can accomplish a lot when motivation is low,
mm-hmm.
if you're able to still grind when you don't want to. And I think that really from a macro perspective, that's ultimately what separates the greats from the average, because it's real easy to do something when you want to do it or you're excited about doing it, but that fades away no matter what it is you're talking about. And eventually it becomes monotonous and boring and painful and it sucks. The ability and willingness to continue to push forward when it does suck and get past it anyway, when motivation is low, that's what I think I extracted the most from kind of that portion of the process. A valuable lesson learned for me, one that I employ regularly, even just, you know, this morning, like my alarm clock goes off at 4:30. I'm like, yeah, no, I'm not doing this today. Like the day off, I don't need to. Like all the justifications and the excuses and rationalizations stop sounding really, really convincing. It's like, no, The only bad workout is the one that didn't happen. So even if you're not at optimal capacity, you're still getting the work in when you otherwise would have done nothing. And that's in repetition, I think, is what leads to ultimate success and progress.
Yeah. And I think that's why I really, I mean, I was excited to talk to you for a couple of different reasons, but one of the main reasons that I actually was excited to talk to you and I was excited about the book is because I think so many veterans, when we get out, struggle with exactly what you were just talking about, that balance of motivation and discipline. When you're not in the military anymore and you're not working towards as many goals possibly or a mission, and you don't have somebody looking over and, you know, forcing you into being disciplined, I think so many guys get in trouble. I know I'm one. If I don't have a race that I'm training for, if I don't have an event that I'm getting ready for, I struggle with that motivation. And then my discipline, if it's not there, things fall through. You know, it happens every time. So I think I want as many veterans to read this book as possible, because I know from just a personal perspective, you know, yeah, I didn't lose a leg, I didn't do this, but you struggle with these basic concepts just to get through normal life, especially when you were used to the military lifestyle for so long.
Yeah, man. And it's, you know, you hit it, especially for, you know, for transitioning vets. I think it's safe to say nothing is a strong word, but I'll use it, that nothing is going to fill that void, fill that vacuum effect like military service. You could probably get close, you know, law enforcement, first responder, kind of these high octane lifestyles and professions. But it's really tough to replicate that. So, you know, what is that next mission? Like, what is my mission? It was dictated to me when I was in military service. Now it's on me to find out what that is. And at the core of, you know, the how question, like, how did you do what you did? How do you do what you do? It's really passion and purpose that is at the center of that, right? Passion being something that you're in love with, and purpose being something that you feel like this is why you were put on earth. Like, I have that now. I'm very blessed to have that now with my lifestyle and my profession. And it, chances are, if I didn't have that when I was in a hospital, I wouldn't be where I am today.
Right.
Like, I needed that level of love and purpose to get passed through all of the adversity. And I think that that's just a critical piece right there, is identifying what that is. What are you passionate about? What is your soul pulling you towards? And having that honest conversation with ourselves, with a high degree of self-awareness, looking yourself in the mirror going, okay, my military service is over or it's coming to an end. Like, what do you want to do? Who do you want to become? And then lay that out in the beginning, you know, working towards it. I think that that's a critical step one of the process.
Yeah. And then I agree with you, because then if you're able to do that, there's going to be a lot of challenges. You're going to have, you know, job loss, you're going to have family issues. That's just life. Yeah. You know what I mean? You're going to have medical issues, all of that. You know, it's how you set yourself up ahead of time, like you said, to kind of deal with those things that are obviously going to be in front of you. If you set yourself up properly as you are transitioning out of the military, now you're set up for success and you can actually do it. If you just jump into it and be like, chips are going to fall where they may and I'll just deal with it, now every lump that gets thrown at you makes it harder and harder instead of being set up to actually tackle it.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, even when you do have that sense of passion, purpose towards the goal, towards the end state, challenges are challenges.
Yeah.
Like, hard times. I experience them all the time. Right. And kind of taking another step forward, start talking about your focus a little bit and our anticipation of challenge. Like, we know it's coming. First off, just know it's coming. Like, you're either in the storm or you're moving towards a storm. That's it. Like, one or the other. So just get your minds wrapped around that. You're in a storm, you're moving towards a storm. So I know the storm is coming. I know the challenge is coming. The adversity is coming. The struggle is coming. We begin to look at those as opportunities, that T intersection. Like, here it is. I'm at that point of pain, frustration, fear, whatever it is. Here I am. It's arrived. I knew it was coming, and here it is. you have to have an opportunity to continue to grind past it, knowing that most people will falter at that point. And then that's what ends up leading to stagnation or regression. Like these exact moments in time, these are the moments you've been waiting for, because it's by enabling yourself to continue to move forward, even if it's at 70%, 50%, 40%, you're still grinding through the pain, through the struggle, through the fear, through the adversity. It's on the backside of that is where the growth exists. Mm-hmm. So just almost seeking out struggle and failure, like actively hunting it down. And it can almost get to the point where you enter the realm of reckless, where you're so thirsty for adversity, because you know through conditioning over time, hey, every time I get past these hard times is when I grow and progress and I level up. Now I'm just hunting these things down. Like I'm actually trying to fall flat on my face. You can enter into the realm of reckless, which is where your strategy comes into play. That's thought out. It's methodical. It makes sense. There's research back behind it. And this is all within Objective Secure. But I think that that's the process of hunting failure, hunting adversity. And what keeps us in the realm of going overboard into the realm of reckless insanity is our actual plan of attack.
Yeah. And it's unfortunate that my mind went here, but I think it is true. What you're talking about, unfortunately, I think society nowadays is teaching people to go in the opposite direction. Find the safe. Find the easy road. Don't put yourself in harm's way. I think, like I coach at a high school level, you know what I mean? And I see kids during practice taking the easy road, not doing the harder drill. If you give the kid two drills, the hard one and the easy one, you'll see the line for the easy one that didn't have to do the five laps before they hit a ball or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Because I think, and it's unfortunate, and I'm sure every generation feels that way about the generation after them. You know, I think that's human nature, but I do see it a lot nowadays that easy way is almost celebrated, that finding ways around adversity is celebrated instead of what you're talking about, which is freaking barreling your head into the adversity, seeking it out, doing the harder things, and then growing from it.
Yeah, you know, you're right. And a few things come to mind, Jay, and I agree. Kind of being conditioned to take the path of least resistance.
Yes.
Yep. And you see it in all sectors and all different industries all over the place. It's most unfortunate when you're talking about kids.
Yes.
Because those are our next people that are running this thing. Mm-hmm. Two things come to mind. One is leadership. And, you know, you're a coach. I didn't know that. It's amazing. It puts a lot of pressure on you, a lot of onus on you, a lot of onus on us as the generation prior. Like, it's easy to look at, you know, millennials or Gen Z or whatever we call the kids nowadays, is being like, these guys are all lazy and worthless and soft. It's like, well, we created this.
Right.
We created this. We're the ones that mentored them or didn't, taught them, coached them. We're the ones that voted on leadership. We're the ones that decided on policy, at least in theory, Democratic Republic, whole thing. Like, this is on us, right? To pull from Jocko, extreme ownership. We need to be looking at ourselves and how did we create what we're seeing as a disaster right now? So leadership comes to mind. We talk about that, right? Like actually mentoring the youth or those around us that no, the growth exists through the struggle. Like you want that. This is a good thing. It's going to hurt, but it's a good thing. Go for it. Keep going. Mm-hmm. And then the community that we surround ourselves with, you know, I consider it to be kind of the ideal tripod, that consisting of mentors, allies, and proteges. Like that's the ideal community. Mm-hmm. Those we look up to and respect and learn from, coaches, teachers, mentors, which nowadays we're not constrained geographically thanks to social media and the internet. You can have a mentor that you've never met who lives on the other side of the planet. So having strong mentorship, having those allies to our left and right, like-minded individuals, ambitious, those that have that work ethic, those that are better than us, that are going to push us, right? And then eventually we earn proteges once we reach a certain point in our craft, and then we become the mentor. We choose who our community consists of, right? Extreme ownership, this is on us. Look at your last 10 text messages. Are those people, do they fit within one of those three categories, or are they toxic? Are they an anchor? Are they a distraction? Like we decide who we invest emotional energy into. That's on us. So just, you know, looking at leadership and community, and then looking at kind of an internal look, like, what did we do to get here? What can I do now as an individual to create that positive impact, I think is the approach I would go. And then lastly, again, seeing kind of the general masses in the trajectory of them, that also brings opportunity. Mm-hmm. Because if most people are going down the path of least resistance, which we know doesn't lead to growth and progress and improvement and leveling up, the masses are going that way. If you have the courage to go against the grain, you're just every time they go left and you go right, you're just that much more ahead. You're extending your lead by that much, or you're making up the ground by that much every single time. So while it's easy, and I'm right there with you, man, you take a look around and you're like, oh man, this is kind of trending in a direction I'm not a fan of, I still have the choice to decide what route I take. And it actually brings opportunity because so many are going that route.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you as far as there is a lot of opportunity out there, especially to get involved in your community, mentor, like you said, and take those challenges head on and show the next generation that it's fun and it can be very rewarding to take those challenges. I was talking to some of the kids during a practice one time, and we had a pretty weak team that we were going to be playing, and they were all excited about playing this weaker team because they thought we were going to win. And I said, you shouldn't be excited. You should be excited to play the county champions. That's the game you should be excited about playing, because there's a good chance you're not going to win, but you're probably going to play your best ball. You're probably going to play the best you've ever played. And yeah, you might lose to them because, okay, maybe they're a better team. But you're going to run plays you've never run before. You're going to be put in situations that you've never run before. And then when you do play that weaker team, you're going to blow them the freak out of the water. You're not going to play down to their level. You're going to destroy them.
Yep.
So, yeah, you know,
absolutely,
it's important. It's really important. And I do think of kind of the next generation when we talk about this stuff, because they need to see it from good, strong leaders and mentors like you're talking about. And veterans can be that in their community if they want to take on that challenge.
I know, man. The experience and the lessons learned and the way we've learned them, especially over the last two decades, is irreplaceable. And shrinking, like, that demographic, mm-hmm. those of us that were in post 9/11 up through even just like a few years ago, as you know, combat has dwindled down and it's going on a downward trajectory, which has a lot of upsides to it. Don't get me wrong. It just places those that have learned through those types of experiences in a much more valuable pool, mm-hmm. because that demographic is continuing to shrink. So in terms of, you know, the veteran population and the potential they have to give back is limitless.
Yeah.
No,
agreed. Agreed. And I think you're seeing it. Like, I don't want it to be a negative, because I do think you're seeing it.
No.
I think you're seeing lot of guys out there using social media, like you said, using the internet for positive, not negative, you know, aligning with other good people, starting businesses, you know, hiring veterans, getting people into good leadership roles, all that kind of stuff. So I do want to say that you know, it's fine to analyze how we're doing, but we are doing pretty good, I think, as a whole. We do a good job, and we just got to continue and grow in it.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it's crazy. I got three buddies that I've worked with, three soft guys that are all running for Congress right now.
It's crazy.
And I've talked to them since then. I'm like, wow, really? And they're like, yeah, dude, I would never have thought that I would be going down this road. Mm-hmm. But I'm looking around, I see, you know, humbly speaking, the value that I can provide through the experiences that we were just talking about. Mm-hmm. And they're extending into that realm. And, you know, it's amazing to see that. So yes, as a whole, it's a source of pride for me to see guys that I know or not, and what they're doing in communities at the lower levels. Like, lower is not the right way to put it, but kind of micro levels, coaching a youth softball team,
board of education,
versus running for Congress.
Yeah.
Right. And like everything in between, you know, it's amazing. Certainly something to be proud of. So I'm proud of. Yeah. But also, as military guys, we know we do an AAR, an after action review. We're looking at the improves. Like, how can we get better?
Yeah.
We did a lot of great stuff. Let's annotate a couple real quick, but now let's just focus on the mistakes that we made and the gaps that we have, so we can bridge that and keep leveling up.
Yeah, for sure. for sure. And shameless plug, but we got to do it. Perfect way to start doing that is to go out and get the book, which I know you're proud of. So I want people to be able to get a hold of this and really learn about this process that you're talking about and we've been talking about through the whole show. Where can they find this book? How do they get their hands on it? Easiest ways, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And I'd like to, Jay, real quick, I just want to touch on the genesis of it because I think it's important.
Please.
You know, first Afghanistan trip as an amputee 2015. Come back from that and, you know, I'm getting thrown into the spotlight by my command, by the Army. They obviously want to highlight, you know, what we're able to do, what our strength and conditioning program is able to do. Really uncomfortable for me. Like I had a very specific perception of what the quiet professional really was. And even to this day, I really don't enjoy the sound of my own voice. It's been a transition that's ongoing. But I start to get a little bit more into social media, a little bit more out there. People are reaching out. And again, the questions are coming in, you know, by the hundreds at first and then by the thousands, which is, how did you do what you did? And this is a lot of brand new amputees or people that are dealing with an injury of some sort or someone that's dealing with some just completely different adversity. And how did you do what you did? And after answering the same question hundreds and thousands of times, I was like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to document on a Microsoft Word doc, cut and dry, just kind of what that process was like for me. I talked earlier about how it really didn't become what it is now until this happened. So it was really a prompt from the greater public that was asking me that same question. So I spent about a week or two or three just kind of slowly, meticulously going through and creating this guide. And again, a lot of self-growth, learned a lot about myself that I didn't know, looking through journals and training logs and meditation, came up with like a 10, 12 page Word doc. Boom, okay. Boom, 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 boom. Here's the manual. Solely for the purpose of efficiency, to be able to just quickly attach, copy, paste, send. Here's your answer. It's a better answer because I've actually given it a lot of thought and analysis, but it's going to speed things up on my end. Boom, 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 boom. And I did that for about a year or so. And then a good buddy of mine, we went to college together. We've been friends 20 plus years. His mother's been in the book industry her whole life. He calls me June of 2020 and says, hey, man, I think you need to write a book, out of the blue. And I'm like, no, I'm actually just finishing up dive school. I was actually at Key West, had about a week left, and I'm ragged, like beat to hell. And he's like, I need you to write a book. I'm like, I cannot have this conversation with you right now. Click. He circles back. He's incessant. He's prodding. He plants a seed. He's got me thinking. He's like, what do you think? And I said, you know what, bro? I kind of already have this product that I've been using as such for the last year or two. And I think that may be something that he's like, keep going with it, go with it, go with it, go with it. And now we're in the summer of 2020. COVID is crazy. Mm-hmm. People are working from their homes, including us in the military, which is a really weird time.
Really?
So weird. I had all this extra, you know, I had this extra time and energy on my hands that I otherwise wouldn't have had. And I don't do well with idle time. Like I need to fill up my days. So I just find myself writing more and more and more. I get pretty obsessed with it to the point where there are times I'm waking up at 2:30 in the morning because I just have to write. Which even when I just say that out loud to you right now, it's like, really? Like, how did that happen?
But you have that personality, I can tell. Like, everything that you keep talking about through this whole thing is whatever it is you're doing, you get obsessed with, and that's what you're going to freaking do. Even though it is writing.
It makes a lot of sense.
It does.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. The fact that it was writing threw me off, but it turns out that I enjoy it. There's a certain therapeutic aspect to it. And you know, analytical perspective to it that I enjoy kind of dissecting and asking that question why and how. And I was doing 400-600 words a day, and next thing you know, I'm at 70,000 words. So the genesis of that is important to me because it still very much is exactly what it was intended to be, you know, three or so years ago, where it's a guide, it's a manual. It answers the question as to how. It also answers the question as to why. But what it is not is an autobiography. It is not, you know, my memoirs. It's not a bunch of, you know, cool guy action stories from Afghanistan where we're buried up to our knees and hand grenade pins. That's not what it is, right? Yes, there are personal examples and vignettes that are within that because I want the reader to be able to put themselves into where my mindset was at the time that I realized that this principle was important and its value it had on me. But it still is what it's intended to be, just in a much more kind of robust and polished form. So it's currently available on Amazon. Right now, the paperback and the ebook are out exclusively on Amazon. The hardcover option is on the way, which will also be available through Amazon. And then I'll also be offering signed, personalized, signed hardcover options as well, which will be available through through our website, which is machinenick.com. That website's got access to all my social platforms. It's got a way to reach out to me for business purposes, like speaking or workshops. You can just reach out to me directly, 3 o'clock in the morning, something weird's on your mind. You know, reach out by all means. I'm extremely meticulous about answering those in reverse order. So I go to the bottom of the inbox and I just work my way up. Sometimes it can take me a week or two, depending on what I got going on, but I'm very deliberate about getting back to people. It's got products that we're involved with, different partnerships that we do stuff with. So you'll be able to find the autographed version of the book on there as well. And then anything else you may be interested in.
Yeah. And there's a link on the website that goes directly to the Amazon page for the soft cover right now. So if you just go to the website, you can click. It'll bring you right over for those that are lazy and don't feel like searching. You know, it's an easy way to do it. Like you said, there's some other stuff that you got going on over there. There's some supplements. There's all sorts of things. There's YouTube videos that you've done. Again, the Instagram is a lot of fun. You do a lot of lives, things like that, where you answer questions and you talk and you go through things. So I think people should definitely check that out as well, because it's a great way to kind of balance the book and a personality that's with it. You know what I mean?
Well, man, thank you.
Yeah. No, like I said, it's been fun following you, you know, and seeing a little bit about you and what this is all about. And again, it spoke to me right away. And never to compare, and I don't compare any two people. Like, everybody has their own challenges. I'm a little over a year out from 3 heart attacks. And I remember sitting in the hospital. Now, I wasn't in the hospital for very long. Nowadays, they try to get you in and out like that. But I remember sitting in the hospital thinking to myself, am I ever going to be able to run a 5K again? Am I going to be able to play with my daughter the way I used to? Am I going to be able to mow my lawn the way that I like to and spend 4 hours outside making my lawn look the way I want? Simple things. Now, fast forward, I'm doing all those things. And I want to make sure that I'm doing them to the best of my ability and that I'm not getting stagnant in just the simple tasks ahead of me. Like, okay, now I am running a 5K. I am mowing the lawn. I want to make sure that I'm running a marathon next year. I want to make sure that I'm not only playing with my daughter, but we're going to the park every day that I'm available and running around like a maniac because that's fun.
Yeah.
And when I see stuff like this and I see people like yourself, it does help me because it's a great way to reinforce the things that I want to do. And I hope that people get that out of this interview, out of the book. Whatever your personal situation, everybody can listen. Whether it's a limb, whether it's a heart attack, whether you're dealing with cancer, family issues, you know, relationship problems, whatever it is, it's good to have something to fall back on and help you plan your way forward in your own way. So I hope that people get that out of this and what Nick is talking about.
Yeah, man, that's awesome. You bring up an awesome point that this project applies to literally everybody. Mm-hmm. And I think we want to be real cautious with comparing ourselves to other situations because it very easily enables justification. You put someone on a pedestal like, well, I'm not that person, so this doesn't apply to me. And that's one of my greatest fears, Jay. I love that you bring this up. It's one of my greatest concerns about this project. As humbly as I can put it, I've heard this feedback where it's, I'm not a 6'6", 260-pound, tatted up Green Beret. So like, what you did and how you did it, that's not for me because I'm a mailman. I am a small business owner. I'm a school teacher. Here come the excuses. Here come the justifications that sound real convincing when you start to look at me just as an example. And I've done this myself with others. That starts to become a real slippery slope where you just start to convince yourself as to why you can't do something.
Right.
Right? Everyone's circumstances are different. Everyone's goals are different. If you're dealing with a challenge that seems monumental to you, then that's real. You are really dealing with something that is that difficult to get past. You may still have all your limbs, but this is still a wall you need to get past. And the methodology that's within that is built deliberately for anybody, right? So you brought up an awesome point. I love that you hammered that home for me. Don't let the cover where it's got this tactical cool guy with one leg freak you out. Like, this isn't going to work for me because I'm not this maniac dude. No, it will. I am not, I wasn't able to do all those things because I'm an SF guy or because I'm tall or because I work out. It's the other way around. Like, I've used these methodologies as an average human being with choices on how I spend my time and energy. And that is what has propelled me to be where I am today, not the other way around. So no matter what industry you're in, what your background looks like, what your challenge you're facing is, this tool will enable that.
That's excellent. That's excellent. And again, I think that's a great point to drive home at the end here, that everybody go out, get the book, use it, you know, analyze it, grow with it, and then apply it to your life, no matter what the challenge is in front of you. And only good things will happen if you take that stance. So, Nick, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. It has been a blast talking to you. I hope we can do this again. I'm sure there's plenty of stuff that we could talk about in the future, but it really has been a pleasure. It's an honor to talk to you.
Awesome, man. Yeah, great to spend some time, Jay. It's crazy how fast time goes by when you're having a really great conversation. Love the platform, man. I'm glad that I was turned on to you. I'm a fan. You got a fan for life. I love the way you're doing it and how you're doing it and why you're doing it. So I give you a lot of credit. Congratulations. I'll continue to follow you, man, and you know, stay on that grind because you are creating a necessary impact, man.
I do appreciate it, man. Thank you very much. And I hope you have a great rest of the day, man.
Likewise, bro. Let's do it again.
All righty. I want to thank Nick for coming on the show. That was just an honor to talk to him. It's a really inspirational story. And I don't say that just because of like overcoming, you know, the adversity and all of that, which listen, take nothing away from that. But it's his perspective. And we talked a little bit about it at the end of the interview there about how this can be for every person. You don't have to have lost a limb. You don't have to have had these major things happen in your life to learn a better way to deal with the challenges that we all deal with on a daily basis, and how to better yourself. And I love the fact that we talked about attacking and seeking out challenging situations, because I don't think we do that enough as a society. We talked about it a little bit during the interview. Again, just an amazing guy. The fact that he ended up back at Fort Bragg within a year, and within 2 years, he was deploying back to Afghanistan in a combat role with his unit, with the team, is just an amazing story. And I was just happy to have him on to talk about it, to be honest with you. So I was a little bit in awe during some of it. I hope you guys got a lot out of that. And again, please get over to Amazon, get the book, Objective Secure. Came out in January. You're going to love this. I'm telling you, this is the book that you're going to want to purchase to start this year off right. Let's get 2022 kickstarted. We're basically 2 months in. We got a lot of year left, and we want the most of it, okay? So buy this book, buy it for a friend, you know, somebody that maybe needs to have a different perspective on the way to tackle those challenges. And, let's share the word and share what Nick is trying to do out there. Again, I want to thank him. So, it was a blast. I really don't have much more, all right? I think it's enough for this week. We're going to have more next week. We're going to have, again, a lot of things going on throughout the year. We want to get real active this year. I have a feeling that, even here in New York, a lot of the COVID restrictions are going to be gone come summertime and stuff. And I want to make sure that we're set up to do as much as possible and have as much fun as we possibly can this year. So be on the lookout for all that stuff. But for this week and for Bulletproof Veteran Podcast, my name is Jason, and thank you for your service.